Well, that was a soggy weekend for a lot of the Midwest, but some areas missed out again. It's raining again in the middle of the country. How long might this last? We've got the machinery man standing by, and we'll hear what the rural health system is doing ready to get ready for this summer.
Live from the mothership via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning we begin with Greg Peterson, Machinery Pete. Then it's National Rural Health Association CEO Alan Morgan. Right after the news from Betsy Gibbon, we'll get a weather update from Kirk Hins of BAMWX. I'm producer Big Apple Joe Stagler, and now, the host of AgriTalk, Chip Flory.
All right, Big Apple Joe, thanks, buddy. Appreciate that, man. How was the weekend?
It was good. You know, really hot on Saturday.
Yeah.
But at least we got rain we needed in South Bend on Sunday.
Good, good, good. Let's bring in Betsy. She's here. How you doing, Betsy?
Hey, I'm doing okay. Joe, I'm impressed with that intro. I'm impressed.
I've been listening to him for about 8 months, so.
So you should have the hang of it.
Love it.
At least you know who you're introducing, right?
Yeah.
That helps.
I wrote it down anyway.
Yeah, yeah, always write it down.
I'm doing well, Chip. How are you guys?
We're good. It was quite the rainy weekend. Felt like we were dodging raindrops all weekend, but we did find a little bit of time on Saturday. Spent a little time on the water. Yesterday, very low key for a Father's Day. Just kind of relaxed.
I was just going to ask you, did you have a good day yesterday?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Talked to the kids, talked to my dad, and I'll say it to him again. Happy Father's Day, Dad.
Aww.
Yeah. And everything was good. Had one of my favorite meals. Yep.
Something meat related, I'm sure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Bratwurst, sauerkraut, baked beans.
Oh, I mean, nice.
Come on.
Nice. Summer
hard
staple.
To beat that. Yes. How's Jim?
Good. I know I didn't get to spend Father's Day with him, but I called him and all that stuff. Yeah. And maybe he can come see me one of these times. But he had a good, relaxing Father's Day. And that's the best you can ask for, really.
That's right. All right. Hey, before we get an update on the weather from Kirk, let's go ahead and get to the news. What do you got?
All right. Excellent. Let's get to the news. Well, there are concerns now about processing facilities, exports, and coronavirus. China announcing Sunday it is halting imports of U.S. poultry from a Tyson Foods Arkansas plant following an outbreak of coronavirus cases at the facility. China's General Administration of Customs saying the suspension includes products which have arrived in China or are about to arrive. Now, according to Farm Journal Washington correspondent Jim Wiesmeyer, Tyson on Friday said it had tested more than 3,700 of its employees at 7 of its Arkansas facilities from June 4th through the 13th, and 481 tested positive for COVID-19. About 95% showed no signs, asymptomatic, when they were tested. Wiesmeyer says a Tyson spokesperson said the company is looking into the matter, adding that health officials say there's no evidence that a virus can be transmitted through food, but interesting to see if this is going to be another kind of kink in the chain, too, with our exports.
That is exactly right, Betsy. It started with some salmon out of Europe, and now it's gone to chicken from the U.S. You wonder if this isn't another one of those, even though all the science shows that the virus cannot be transmitted through food. You wonder if this is another one of China's fabricated trade barriers that could get in the way. Yeah.
Right. Well, we'll see what happens with that. Yeah. And of course, we did have some news break over the weekend. Many farmers breathing a sigh of relief, at least for this year, as the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled against a petition to halt all uses of Engenia, Fexapan, Xtendimax, Dicamba herbicides. That means farmers will be allowed to use their existing stocks, quote, existing, on the products. Yeah. It comes at a time when many farmers are under the state deadlines to spray those products. Many face deadlines to spray by the end of this month. Under EPA guidance, farmers can use the existing stocks in their possession as of June 3rd, and all applications must be completed no later than July 31st. Again, it depends which state you're in. But this ruling does not change the earlier decision by the same court, which said it vacated the federal registration for the three over-the-top products. So that's the update we have as of right now.
That's a sigh of relief for many producers, not all producers. Some of them are saying, doggone it, let's get it out of the field. But it's a sigh of relief for many producers, and it still is changing plans for next year. So that's something that we're going to have to stay on top of.
Yeah, yeah. Chip, do I have time for one more story? Should I save
it for tomorrow? Absolutely, you do. Absolutely.
All right. All right. Excellent. Well, it's kind of a tale of different weather forecasts, like you said, between the Eastern Corn Belt and the Western Corn Belt, and it's really spotty. And I took this off the Pro Farmer newsletter this morning, but as much as 15 to 20% of the Midwest may see a stressful crop and stressful crop conditions develop over the next 2 weeks. That's according to the Commodity Weather Group. Rains will continue to move out through the Eastern Corn Belt over the next 24 to 36 hours, redeveloping from west to east later this week through the weekend. And Chip, it's going to be interesting to, I think, look at the next drought monitor, because the one previous, it showed southeast South Dakota just so dry, and it really went from extremely dry to wet. I know Dad received 3 inches since Thursday. Some areas got hail. Illinois, of course, has received some rain. But when you look at the June 9 map, it really showed no drought in the Eastern Corn Belt. And now some is starting to creep up on the latest drought monitor. That'll be interesting. Now, I went and visited a farmer in Jasper County, Indiana, and that was on Wednesday, and I was amazed to see how much yellow was in the field. Again, this was before Thursday when the latest drought monitor came out, and he said that he's fighting some dry conditions. So, Joe, if you want to play this, this is Dave Rodabaugh in Jasper County.
Had several stops during the way in terms of rain, so our crop is spread out a little bit. In terms of the planting dates, but got a good crop going, good prospects. But right now we're looking for some rain. We always need something, and usually that's out of our control. But we need some rain now.
It's gonna be interesting. See the next drought monitor. See how things look. Because now Indiana's colored in it.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you, Betsy. Appreciate it. Let's get an update on the weather right now from Kirk Hinz, BAMWX.com. Kirk, you heard some of what Betsy was talking about there. Uh-huh. Boy, some welcome relief over the weekend in a lot of areas.
Yeah, it was some very, very timely rains, especially for portions of like the Midwest, Eastern Iowa, Illinois got some good soaking rains. I would say even Ohio. It's funny she mentioned Indiana. We got some timely rain. I don't want to say we completely missed out, but I will definitely say we missed the most of it. So I wouldn't say things have gotten significantly better versus, you know, this time last week.
Okay. I keep hearing this talk, the rumblings that there's going to be a ridge established later this month and into early July, right?
Yeah, that's the latest guidance, and it keeps getting stronger on it as well. Things are we've been kind of really warm west, and then lately we've been a little bit warm east, but right now it's looking to be setting up shop kind of across the central United States, and it looks like a good shot of significant heat too, to like you said, exactly to end the month and kind of open up 4th of July. So that is an increasing trend as of late.
Yeah. Any indication, you said that it's been strengthening, and I know if one of those ridges becomes entrenched, it can be hard to bust that pattern.
It can, especially when you include a lot more higher pressure up there in areas like Greenland and Canada. When you get that kind of a pattern, it can hold more of that ridge steady, and that is the concern as we kind of go forward, more prolonged warmth.
Yeah, yeah. Especially since that would be getting us right into the time when we're going to be seeing the corn crop pollinating across the Midwest.
Exactly, yep.
Kirk.
Bears watching very closely.
Very good. Thank you, sir. We'll talk to you again soon. Thanks, man.
All right. Appreciate it, Chip.
Kirk Hinz, BAMWX.com. We're getting an update from Greg Peterson next. Everyone talks big yields, but Channel Seedsmen deliver advice that yields results. Every season, Channel Seedsmen match elite seed products with unmatched service and support to push the performance of every acre. That's why you can count on Channel for what you need to make the most of your season. You don't have to be a Channel customer to take advantage of this support. Visit channel.com/agritalk to sign up and receive expert advice that yields.
AgriTalk is brought to you by Bear Plus Rewards. Sign in and start earning at mybearplus.com.
Welcome back to AgriTalk. Glad that you could join us this morning to start your week. I'm your host, Chip Flory. Davis is taking a little time off this week. He'll be back later towards the end of the week. You know what? I am really looking forward to this conversation here with Greg Peterson from Machinery Pete. And the reason being there, well, number one, Greg, I'm always looking forward to the conversation with you. How you doing, man?
Hey, doing well, Chip. How you doing?
I'm doing just fine. Now, the last time, last week, we talked about getting ready for a Sullivan Brothers auction, I believe it was, or Sullivan Auctioneers event. That it was an online event, but I remember going down the list of the equipment that was on this auction and thinking to myself, Greg, this is the kind of stuff that tops markets every week, and it's all on one auction. So
yeah,
how did this go?
Well, if folks, if you saw the YouTube video we posted, my friend Dan Sullivan sent me a little note, a little roundup. It was gangbusters, the sale Friday, really? June 19th, just southwest of Chicago in Morris, Illinois. It was an estate sale. Gemini Farms, guy by the name of Jim Bedeker, had made a fortune in the trucking, in the trucking business. And he grew up on a farm. He's a farmer at heart. His line of equipment was just incredible, Chip. And people probably talking about a couple of the items I highlighted on the in the video and in the blog on Friday. But he had a 2018 John Deere 9620RX. Of course, track tractors have been hot. This yep. thing had 623 hours on it. And it had warranty, limited powertrain until a year from now or 3,000 hours. But it brought $407,000, which... Some people might look at that and go, wow, that's really cheap, you know, compared to a new one. But, you know, man, over three decades, I've been tracking this stuff day by day, and that's the highest auction price ever on a modern tractor, $407,000. In fact, it went $22,200 over the previous high, which was only set back in March on another 9620RX that sold around Carthage, I think. That was a 16 model, 1,000 hours, went for $385,200. So 407 was amazing, and just a couple other highlights from the sale Friday, Chip. They had a combine, a 2018 John Deere S780. It was a two-wheel drive, 455 engine hours. That sold for $345,000. Just for perspective, the average this year on an S780 is about $320,500, so about $25,000 over the average. Sprayer, they had a big 17 Hagee SDS 12, 1,200-gallon rig, under 400 hours. That brought $283,000, second-highest auction price ever on an SDS 12. We set another record on the planter. They had a 2018 John Deere DB60 36-row 20-inch, and I don't believe it was, like, fully specced out with every precision ag type of option. But nonetheless... had 4,235 acres on it, but still brought $252,000, which I looked, Chip, I've seen 15,915 planters sold the last 20 years. Oh, 252 is the highest I've ever seen.
Wow.
And then a couple semis that really were just beautiful on the sale. A pair of 04 Peterbilt 379s, Cat C15 engines. I went down 2 weeks ago to look at this stuff because we're doing some TV show stuff on it, and those trucks were just gorgeous.
Yeah.
One brought 106, one brought 96. I think those were the fourth and fifth highest the last 4.5 years on a 379. And then the skid steer, they had an 18 Kubota SVL 95-2, 134 hours on it. I mean, just like new.
Oh, geez.
That brought $60,500. It's the highest Kubota skid steer I've ever seen and the ninth highest ever skid steer. So... It was just incredible sale Friday.
Okay, so as I was thinking about that sale after last week's conversation mm-hmm. with you and thinking about that equipment listing, I went and looked at the listing, and my initial thought was there's not enough money to go around for that kind of equipment.
Right.
But when it goes online... obviously, there is. I can't imagine that all of this equipment stayed in the Morris, Illinois area.
No. We're living in a different world now. COVID-19, yep. We've talked about it, Chip, but it absolutely was a direct injection of lighter fluid to the burning coals of the online movement. And whether it's an online only or just online bidding, I mean, a sale like this or sales with older equipment that's super nice, they just... it's moths to the flame. And again, because the new price of new is so incredibly high, that even that two-year-old 9620RX at 407, again, even though some people go, that's nuts. Hey, you know, what are your other options? You got, right. You've got about 2,400 hours of warranty there, and it's a lot less than new. So yeah, the buyers come from all over, and of course, Sullivan's and other great auction companies figured out long ago that, and it's not like the old days of put up the sale bills in the coffee shop and that's good enough. Nope.
Right.
I mean, you have to do everything to get the word out everywhere, worldwide, and they do, and this is the result.
Yeah. It's just, I don't know what the final tally was on this auction, but it had to be for the pieces of equipment on there. This was a record setter.
Yeah, I guess I didn't ask Dan and the guys for a total number. I know it's a very interesting figure, and I'll find out. We're actually doing some more follow-up filming for our TV show on this sale. But I think my guess is strong hunch. Well, I know it's true. That the numbers came in over kind of the estimates, and Sullivan and other great auction companies, they're very accurate in their estimates. But again, when it's this nice, the reaction you had looking through the list, that's, you know, what happens is people see that, or maybe they see like those Peterbilts on the sale and they wind up forwarding to 10 of their friends. Geez, look at those two 04
piece,
those 379s. And then all of a sudden some guy in Idaho's on it, and
yep,
now you got four people bidding on instead of two, and it goes for a premium. That's the way it works.
Yeah, exactly. Wow, that's fantastic. Good for them. Okay, before we get to what you got coming up this week, what about take us into South Dakota and Indiana?
Yeah, a couple sales Saturday that were really interesting. Saturday in Markleville, Indiana, my good friend Jeff Boone, with Jeff Boone and Associates, had their big consignment sale. I think they pushed it back from the pandemic stuff, but great list of equipment. And they had a couple tractors, kind of a farm auction within the consignment sale. I think it was Lee Farms was the name of the outfit, but they had a 94 John Deere 4760, 2,460 hours mechanical front, one owner. That sold for $65K, very solid price there. And the same folks had an 84 John Deere 4250 two-wheel drive, 3,340 hours, one owner. That sold for $44,000. So Jeff had sent me a preview video last Thursday, I think, and he stood by the tractors and talked about them. And same deal here. It's not like the one and two-year-old stuff, Chip, but, you know, this 25, 35-year-old stuff, whatever color, if it's nice like this one owner, boy, you know, buyers find it from wherever. So a good sale there in Indiana. And over in South Dakota Saturday, kind of northeast part of the state, they had a four-wheel drive, a John Deere 8870. Solid machine. I can't remember the number of hours off the top of my head. It was pretty reasonable to low, not crazy low. But anyway, it brought $45K, which is the highest auction price in the U.S. in 5 years on an 8870 Deere. Now, we're two or three higher in Canada, but like I've been talking about for 10 years now, the four-wheel drive market is always higher in Canada. So pretty strong sale there in South Dakota.
All right. You've got one coming up here Thursday, Buffalo Center, Iowa. What's happening there? What's highlighting that one?
Actually, that was this past Thursday, Chip. Nice sale by Hallberg Auction there had a sale. It was a farm estate sale. Guy's name was Joe, I think it was Badgy, but he had a couple tractors that were really nice. He had a 89 John Deere 4455 two-wheel drive, 5,197 hours, quad-range, second owner. And I posted a YouTube video of this last night, folks. You can go watch it sell. We're at $43,500. So good, strong price there on a two-wheel drive. If you're into Alice Chalmers, he had a 63 Alice D12 restored, looked really sharp. That brought $7,900. And then if you're a 4020 lover, Joe had a 69 4020 with a cab, 10,873 hours, synchro, one owner, original, purchased new in Little Elmore, Minnesota. I love Elmore. It's the home of Walter Mondale, former vice president. My best buddy grew up in Elmore. But that 4020 brought $13,000.
Oh, nice.
Good sale there in Buffalo Center on, that was, last Thursday.
No doubt. No doubt. Okay. Hey, everybody, you got to check out the Machine Repeat podcast. He's got another chapter on the Flying Combine, the Silver Bullet. You got to check that out. And Greg's also got the story of a 1968 Dodge Charger. It was a barn find, sold for $17,000. You got to check that out. Good stuff, Greg. Thanks, man. That is Greg Peterson, Machine Repeat. Okay, coming up next, we're going to get an update on the rural health situation from Alan Morgan.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from Pro Farmer.
And joining us now is Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady. Brian, this corn's feeling a little heavy today. What's going on?
Yeah, well, we had a little bit of corrective buying late last week, so a little bit of short covering, and we're seeing an end to that. The weather is deemed mostly favorable. We had some rains move through the Corn Belt over the weekend. Now, they were highly scattered, and some areas got heavy rains, and some hardly got any at all, if any. But yet the trade has deemed the conditions as favorable, and as a result, we're under pressure here this morning.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not getting much help from soybeans, but just the simple fact that wheat is not trading lower might be helping corn out a little bit.
Yeah, wheat has turned around. We did see some pressure in the SRW market earlier on, and it has found a little bit of buying interest. So that's probably going to help corn a little bit, but I think just seasonally, as we've talked about, the wheat market, it's an uphill battle for that until we get further along in harvest. And so just mild corrective buying so far this morning in the winter wheat markets.
Boy, it's hard to find a buyer in the nearby lean hog trade this morning, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think some of that has to do with China and the poultry stuff with the Arkansas Tyson plant shutting off the exports from there, and the concern that what could happen with some of the pork plants. Now, I think the difference is China probably doesn't need the chicken as much as they need pork, and as a result, unlikely that they would do something on that on the pork side of things, but it can't be ruled out, and it's definitely spooking the market so far this morning.
Yeah, no doubt. Real quick, cattle.
Cattle under a little bit of pressure. Last Friday's cattle on feed report just mildly negative compared to pre-report expectations, and just shows a backlog of animals.
Thanks, Brian. This is Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors.
I'm Andrew McRae, inviting you to join me for Farming the Countryside, a farmer-focused podcast important to agriculture. Brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Visit pivotbio.com to find a representative near you.
All right, welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm your host, Chip Flory. Man, what a sales report we got from Greg Peterson, machinerypete.com. And I sold him a little short on a couple of items that he wanted to talk about, but just go to machinerypete.com. You can find his podcast there and learn all about that 68 Dodge Charger that was a barn find, and the latest update on that Silver Bullet. That's a fun story that Greg is telling. Okay, let's get an update from Alan Morgan. Alan is the CEO of the National Rural Health Association. He joins us right now. Alan, it's good to talk with you again. How are you?
I'm doing well. I appreciate being back. I think last time I was on, I had to say, I think this may happen, and not really sure. And now this time I can actually tell you what's happening. So it's a nice change.
It is a good change. It is a good change. So give us an update. How did, and in that update, I got to throw this out there because there is so much speculation that with some of the areas that are reopening for business that we're going to see this second wave of COVID cases, and states that rely heavily on the rural health system have been some of the earliest to reopen. So let's talk about the signs of that second wave too.
Yeah, of course. Well, we are, I guess, almost halfway through the year. And at the beginning of the year, the whole discussion was on New York City and everything that's happening in the city, and will it hit rural America? I think now we can say there are small towns out there that are not on interstate highways. They don't have major processing plants. They don't have prison systems there. They haven't seen any coronavirus cases, and they may not. But what we do know for a fact is if you're in a small town and you've got a population of people coming into your community, working there closely together, then leaving your community, chances are good you've had an outbreak, and chances are good you're going to have an outbreak coming up. The story this summer really shifts from the cities to the rural communities right now. Looking nationally, that small towns all across the U.S. that have these processing plants, prisons, our long interstate highways, they're all seeing an upsurge of cases at this point.
Okay. The locations, and like you said, the what's happening in these smaller towns has a lot to do with, you know, the number of people coming in and out of town, and if it just increases the risk. With some of the reopenings that have happened, I'm thinking about Texas, I'm thinking about the South, I'm thinking about Wisconsin, and some of the changes up there with the Supreme Court saying, no, you can't shut these places down. Was there any noticeable uptick that is telling other states what to watch for?
Yeah. I think okay. It's just look at the data. And I got to be honest with you, I'm like most people. I'm watching the news, and the news is telling me, okay, we made it through the first wave. We're okay for now. We're waiting for the second wave. Well, that people need to know. That's for New York City. That is not from small towns and across the upper Midwest and Southeast, as you mentioned, and that they really, these small towns have seen a steady cases coming in. And I'll be honest with you, from Memorial Day weekend, you look 2 weeks out from Memorial Day weekend, and that's when we've seen a slight increase across rural America. People felt safe. They got out. They did things. Stores have since reopened. And so we're not at a crisis point in a lot of small towns. Well, you have to make sure you have an exemption for Texas and small towns in Florida and certainly small towns in Arizona. But upper Midwest, it's just really been a steady flow for a lot of these rural communities.
Yeah. With the amount of testing that is happening at the meatpacking plants, Alan, the confirmation numbers are really kind of staggering in some cases, but just as staggering to me are the number of asymptomatic cases. They're carrying the virus and have no idea that they're carrying the virus, right?
Yeah, and again, I'm just talking from a public health perspective. I'm not really focused as much as the positive cases, because you do more testing, you're going to get more positive cases. Everyone knows that. What I'm worried about is the percentage of those tests which are positive. Once you get above 10% of those positives in any small towns, that means you've got a lot more people out there that are positive you don't know about. Right. And at the end of the day, everyone needs to watch what's happening with hospitalizations, because that's really, let's get back to it, do you have the capacity to be able to have a hospital bed when you need? And that's a scary part. And a lot of these Alabama, Texas, a lot of these southern places, southern states, they're getting awfully close to bed capacity. And that's when scary things happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about that preparedness now. The personal protection equipment, the space in the hospitals, what's the status there? Is this another prepare for the worst and hope for the best kind of scenario?
Yeah. So I can say across the U.S. right now, hospitals have the equipment they want and they need until they hit these surge moments. And that's when, fortunately, FEMA and CDC and HHS are able to drop into these counties and help coordinate the distribution. When these small hospitals, they hit a surge, I don't care where they're at, they have a problem with masks, gowns, testing supplies, just for who they are. I mean, we're small towns. We do not keep large rooms full of supplies. We never will. And so we're always going to have that issue.
Right. Okay. You know, in the conversations that we've had so far, Alan, and I really appreciate you coming on that on AgriTalk and giving everybody an update what's going on. But we've focused on the virus. Let's talk about, and you know, I don't, don't think that I'm diminishing the importance of this by calling it a side effect of COVID, but let's talk about the mental health services that are available through the rural health system. How common is it for a county hospital to offer mental health services?
Yeah, that's a huge issue, and I'm so glad you brought that up. You know, last year, both Farm Bureau and Farmers Union collaborated together to highlight the challenges and the problems of behavioral health among our nation's farmers and ranchers. And it was just really good to see that. Everyone knows that. I mean, I'm from a small town in Kansas myself, and we do not like to see behavioral health specialists. It's just who we are. But in this particular time, when you've seen, you've already had the reporting what's happening to the ag industry out there, there is a greater need than ever before. And so that's bad news. But the good news is the federal government has really relaxed regulations on telehealth. And I got to tell you, most people out there, either by phone or by some sort of interactive video, maybe FaceTime or Skype, they feel comfortable talking on a phone and talking on video than they do driving in to an office. And so that's what I want to assure your listeners. If you feel that you'd like to have some behavioral health services, contact your provider. They can get you set up so that way, in many cases, you don't have to go in. You can get the help you need, thankfully, because of this crisis, now either through a phone or through your computer.
Okay. What if you are out there in rural America and you are concerned about a neighbor, a friend, someone that's dealing with really tough issues? How do you get that person help?
Yeah, that's so good. And that is the strong suit. That's one thing we have in rural America, and one of the highlights of living in rural America is that sense of community, looking after your neighbor, looking after your family. That is one of the reasons why we live here. And so now is definitely the time. If you're concerned about a loved one, family member, or friend, make sure you're talking with them. And even if it would be more helpful for them, go online and find a local provider in your community, if you know the physician, and just help make that connection for them.
Okay. Yeah, that's a difficult conversation to have, but we need to work up the courage to go ahead and have those conversations, no doubt. Finance. This has been such a tough time financially for the rural health system. Alan, where do we stand right now?
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing me on. And over the years that I've talked with you about this, rural hospitals are closing. Rural health is facing difficult times. I can tell you, as of today, this is unusual in the last 30 years. But because of the federal government and the CARES Act that was passed, hospitals and clinics out there financially, as of right now today, are fairly well prepared, which is fantastic financially. We had 12 rural hospitals close in April already this year. But that funding from the federal government stabilized our health system for this month and for next month. Now, the problem is, did we save all these rural hospitals and clinics only to kill them in the fall? I don't know the answer to that. But what's going to happen is these rural hospitals are now going to reopen for outpatient services and elective services.
Yeah.
And a small town, their community will come back to their hospital. We can keep these rural hospitals and clinics open. But like we've talked about, if they start having surges of cases and people are not comfortable going to the hospital, we're going to have real problems this fall all across the country.
Yeah. Yeah, that comfort level in seeking out some health care when you need it. If you need it, you need it. Right, Alan? You've got to go in and get it.
Yeah, you can't put that off. But what I'm talking about is, and you know this, it's the colonoscopies, the breast exams, you know, basic preventive medicine we all, especially our nation's farmers and ranchers, need to be taking care of themselves. And are you comfortable going in for those tests you know you need them? Or are you going to say, you know, I think I'll put this off? And that's where we run into problems.
Gotcha. Alan, we'll do it again, not too distant future. We need to stay on top of this. Thank you so much, sir.
Really appreciate it. Thank you.
You bet. That is Alan Morgan, CEO of National Rural Health Association.
AgriTalk is brought to you by Bear Plus Rewards. Sign in and start earning at mybearplus.com.
Welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm Chip Flory. One of the news stories that Betsy had at the start was about dicamba, of course. And we can go ahead and continue to use the product, or producers can go ahead and continue to use the product. Stocks that they had in place on June 3rd, they can use them until July 31. But like I said to Betsy, the bigger question may not be for 2020. It is, of course, for 2021. BASF is out with a statement saying that they are, let's go straight to this. We are committed. This is from BASF. We are committed to pursue all legal remedies available to ensure farmers have access to the safe and effective crop protection solutions they have come to rely on. Or are, in this case, becoming to rely on. But this is going to be a battle, you guys. My goodness. This is absolutely going to be a battle. The chemical companies are going to be bringing out everything that they can to make sure that the billions of dollars of research and development that have gone into these dicamba products, whether it be on the seed side or on the chemical side, are available for use. And the opinion on this from growers that I've talked to in the last 3 days, even just over the weekend, what a range. It's unbelievable how one grower might say the only reason that I was using it was play defense because all the neighbors were using it, and I'm not going to use it, but I didn't want to risk risk any damage from my neighbors with drift. And other farmers saying this stuff works. I've got to have it. The water hemp is out of control. If I can't use this dicamba, so it's such a wide range, and that's in a small group. That is in a small group. So there's going to be a lot of, boy, this is another one of those issues that I'm just afraid is going to be a divisive issue in agriculture, even more than what it has been and in different areas than when it started, when it first caught fire down south. We've talked a lot about the weather today. Kirk Hinz was on talking about that ridge bringing some heat in as we flip the calendar over to July. Well, the National Weather Service 6 to 10 day outlook for June 27th through July 1 calls for those hot temperatures in the middle of the country and across the entire Corn Belt. We've got above normal temperatures expected in June 27 to July 1, but it's going to be that, as we describe, as sneaky heat if the precipitation forecast holds, because we've still got the chances for above normal precipitation through most of the Corn Belt. Well, all the areas that rely on dry land that do not rely on irrigation are looking at above normal precipitation for that June 27 to July 1. And it's a little weird when you flip over to the 8 to 14 day, it's like the maps barely changed. This is for June 29 through the 5th, above normal temperatures expected over the entire Corn Belt. And again, the above normal precipitation over most Corn Belt areas for that June 29 to July 5 period. Pretty crazy stuff. Temperatures are going to be warming up. And of course, like I mentioned with Kirk, the timing of heat is going to be really, really interesting. Big Apple Joe Stackler, producer of AgriTalk. Did you see any of the weather data from weather variables from over the weekend? I'm thinking about Russia, okay? You get down into the crop region, you know, where they're growing grain, where they're growing wheat, they had a freeze. Freeze over the weekend.
They usually have snow over there, don't they?
Well, this is a little different. But the area that up in the Arctic Circle, mm-hmm. you know, northern Siberia, The high temperature over the weekend was 100.4 degrees inside the Arctic Circle.
Yeah. Plus, not minus?
That's a plus. Yes, Fahrenheit.
Wow.
Unbelievable. I saw it. I was getting ready to head to the office. My wife had on the Today Show, and the Today Show guy that was in for Al was talking about this, and he did a really nice job of explaining it. He said, listen, some people are going to want to say that this is a climate event. It's not. It's a weather event. Now, the climate change may be intensifying some of these weather events, but nonetheless, for the first time, they had a recorded temperature, and they're waiting for official confirmation, but they had a recorded temperature of 100-plus degrees inside the Arctic Circle over the weekend.
That official
and freezing temperatures in southern Russia. Crazy.
They're waiting for official confirmation from Pravda?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. Alan is so good to come on here and give us the updates that he's given us, Joe. Yeah. What struck you the most from that conversation?
I would say, for one thing, to remind people in rural America that when they're hearing these numbers about first wave versus second wave, that they're probably hearing what it means for New York. And it's a different story for rural America. So like New York City may be on the cusp of a second wave, whereas rural America is basically still getting through the first wave. So you can't take the recommendations or what they're saying, phases and all that sort of thing, and apply it from one region to, you know, where you might be.
Right. Yeah, good point. Good point. You know, and on the mental health side, when you're working up the courage to go talk to a neighbor or just pick up the phone and talk to a neighbor that you might be concerned about, just using the words, I'm worried about you, can sometimes give them that nudge that hey, I better get some help. All right. Hey, thanks for listening this morning. Appreciate it. Come back this afternoon. We're going to have a conversation with Jim Bauer from Bauer Trading. You know, those are always good conversations. And tomorrow morning, Ag Investments. Going to be talking with Ann Deignan from JP Morgan. Have a good day. Join us again at 206.